Welcome to China Focus. I'm Jim Stevenson. My co-host Sarah Williams has the week off. Coming up, more U.S.-China military cooperation needed to prevent conflicts. China and South Korea slam Japan for honoring war criminals. China crackdown on dual citizens causes concern. Which Chinese company is expected to make a big splash on its IPO next month? And as students go back to school, we want to find out exactly what's involved in the application process for Chinese students to come to America. And how do Chinese students fare at American universities? Hello and welcome to China Focus. Analysts say a close encounter last week between a U.S. surveillance plane and a Chinese fighter jet shows the need for greater military cooperation and agreed-upon rules of engagement between the two countries. The Pentagon says the U.S. plane was in international airspace about 200 kilometers east of China's southern island of Hainan when it was confronted by the Chinese jet last Tuesday. Pentagon spokesman John Kirby called the Chinese pilot's actions aggressive and unprofessional and said the Pentagon expressed to Beijing its strong objection at the maneuver. The Chinese Defense Ministry called the criticism totally groundless. In a statement, it insisted the pilot acted professionally and kept a safe distance. The statement said any blame for the incident lies with the American plane and demanded the U.S. stop conducting reconnaissance missions near China. Brad Glosserman, executive director of the security think tank Pacific Forum in Hawaii, says there is a fundamental disagreement between the two governments over continued U.S. reconnaissance of Chinese military activity.
The Americans believe that they are legally permitted to conduct surveillance operations in the 200-mile exclusive economic zone, and the Chinese believe they're not. And consequently, they will engage in such behavior to discourage the Americans and to make clear their positions on these questions. And this, I think, is that attempt to signal the Americans' Chinese displeasure and then pumped up a little bit or pumped up considerably by the Top Gun antics of some Chinese fighter pilot, which is not unusual by any means.
Glosserman says the two militaries view each other as competitors and potential adversaries, and that, he says, will limit the ability to cooperate. China and South Korea called for Japan to reflect on its history of aggression a day after Tokyo confirmed Prime Minister Shinzo Abe sent a message to a ceremony honoring World War II-era war dead many considered to be Japanese war criminals. Prime Minister Abe's note was read at an April ceremony held at a temple in western Japan to honor hundreds of convicted and suspected war criminals. Japan's chief cabinet secretary on Wednesday acknowledged Mr. Abe sent the note, but said the move was made in his capacity as head of Japan's ruling party, not as prime minister. On Thursday, a China foreign ministry spokesperson called on Japan to make a clean break with militarism in order to help provide a foundation for better relations with its Asian neighbors. The top leaders of China and South Korea have refused to meet with Prime Minister Abe since he visited the controversial Yasukuni Shrine, which honors 14 Class A war criminals. Zimbabwe's President Robert Mugabe is in China on a five-day state visit. The trip comes after he was snubbed by U.S. President Barack Obama, who did not invite him to the recent U.S.-Africa summit. The longtime leader is reportedly seeking a $4 billion financial boost for his nation's struggling economy. From VOA's Southern Africa Bureau in Johannesburg, Anita Powell has more.
Zimbabwean President Robert Mugabe has long been known for his fiery, combative, anti-Western rhetoric. And so, as he ventured east this week for a five-day state visit to China, the host government greeted him with a 21-gun salute. It's an increasingly rare welcome for a leader who has fewer and fewer places to turn. Mr. Mugabe sought support from China during Zimbabwe's independence struggle in the late 1970s. Zimbabwe's economy is once again in turmoil, with widespread power outages and reports of companies being forced to close or stop paying employees. The two nations have long had financial ties, with a number of Chinese mining and construction firms already working in Zimbabwe. Zimbabwe is rich in natural resources like minerals, timber, and metals, making it a potentially lucrative investment for China. Anita Powell, VOA News, Johannesburg.
This is China Focus on the Voice of America. Coming up, U.S. investors ready themselves for perhaps the biggest initial public offering ever. A multinational anti-terror drill was conducted by the Shanghai Cooperation Organization in North China's Inner Mongolia this week. Deputy chiefs of the general staff from China, Kazakhstan, Kyrgyzstan, and Tajikistan, and a deputy commander of Russia's Eastern Military Command participated in the drill. The joint exercise, codenamed Peace Mission 2014, aims to deter the three evil forces of terrorism, separatism, and extremism, said Wang Ning, chief director of the drill and deputy chief of the general staff of the People's Liberation Army. For more, I asked VOA's Beijing correspondent Bill Ide on the significance of the exercises in light of the recent attacks in China.
It's both in the air and on the ground. They've got 7,000 troops who are participating. There's going to be tanks and missiles and even drones that are going to be used in these exercises as well. The holding of these exercises comes at a time when China has faced its largest number of violent attacks over the past year, not only in Xinjiang, but in other parts of the country. We've seen attacks in Beijing, in the south at a train station, in Kunming in the southern province of Yunnan. So China really is facing what some have described as an insurgency, almost, in its far western region of Xinjiang. The issue of terrorism is one of the top concerns for the administration of President Xi Jinping.
It has been a concern by some outside of China that Beijing's actions have been to push into regions like Xinjiang, although they really do have a problem with serious attacks.
Yes. Over the past year, things have gotten a lot more violent than they have been in the past. It would be a group of people perhaps attacking a police station, and the targets largely would be government offices because, as critics overseas would argue, that there's so much oppression there that is going on in Xinjiang of the Uyghurs that there's a backlash against the government and against authorities. But what we've seen over the past year is that increasingly civilians are also being targeted, and so it's taken a dramatic sea change. The attack that occurred in Kunming train station has been described here in China as China's 9/11. That gives you a sense of like how serious China is taking these attacks. At the same time, access to independent information on what is going on is still very limited, so it's very hard to tell what is really going on here.
U.S. investors are getting ready for Chinese e-commerce giant Alibaba's market debut next month. And when it begins trading at the market value of perhaps $200 billion, it will potentially make it one of the biggest initial public offerings or IPOs ever. Reuters reports some investors may shed less profitable companies like Amazon to make room for Alibaba. According to Bloomberg News, Alibaba is looking to sell at a 12% stake in the IPO, and as a result, the company could raise more than $20 billion and rank among the largest ever in the United States. Scott Kennedy is director of Indiana University's Research Center for Chinese Politics and Business, and he tells VOA's Victor Beatty it would be an exciting company to be a part of.
Private, not state-owned, has very strong fundamentals and is dominating in several areas of business. And so it's going to definitely draw attention from American investors who most of the time are choosing amongst companies which are doing well but operating in a very slow-growing American economy.
There are rivals in China like Baidu and Tencent Holdings. Why does Alibaba corner the market, nearly 80% of all online commerce in China?
Online businesses tend to have not just economies of scale, but network effects where people want to use the same website that everyone else is using. It makes the business easier. And Alibaba has just had an excellent business model and done super well.
Well, Scott, with tensions, as you well know, between the United States and China over cyber spying, over military tensions, security matters in the South China Sea, it would seem that an unveiling like Alibaba would further integrate the U.S. and Chinese economies.
Well, that's the strange thing about the 21st century. You can have pretty serious security tensions between countries, even differences over political systems and culture, but be economically tied at the hip. And even though there are areas where the U.S. and Chinese economies compete quite vigorously, this is largely a complementary win-win.
The U.S. management consulting firm McKinsey & Company says by 2020, online retail sales in China could reach $650 billion, as much as the United States, Japan, the United Kingdom, Germany, and France combined. China's Ministry of Public Security has announced a new policy to encourage reporting people who obtain citizenship in another country but still keep their Chinese citizenship. The move has led to a sharp debate about dual citizenship and the impact of the crackdown on Chinese who live abroad. Hu Wei reports from Washington.
Observers say the new policy is at least in part aimed at so-called naked officials, public servants who have family and assets overseas that could allow them to hide the gains of corruption. There are believed to be thousands of the so-called naked officials, but the exact figure is unknown. In recent years, demands for dual citizenship have become louder. But Professor Tong Zhiwei at the East China University of Political Science and Law in Shanghai says the issue is complicated. Tong says, on the one hand, dual citizenship is beneficial to individuals, namely the many overseas Chinese who study and do business abroad. By keeping dual citizenship, they do not need to go through the whole visa application process, and they can enjoy rights and benefits offered by both countries. But he adds, the Chinese government has its own concerns about dual citizenship. Tong says, for example, when a Chinese who holds an American passport commits a crime or has confrontation with the Chinese government, in case he or she is detained or tried in China, the Chinese government will have to inform and work with the U.S. on his case. He says this is not only a cumbersome process, but also gives foreign countries excuses to interfere with China's internal affairs. Enacting legal dual citizenship does not appear to be a priority in the near term, so some are calling on Beijing to expand its green card program, which lets foreign citizens live and work inside China. Hu Wei, VOA News, Washington.
Late August and early September means it's that time of the year when students go back to school in many parts of the world. As thousands of China's wealthier high school students prepare to begin their school year abroad, an increasing number are likely looking to board flights to Vancouver and Toronto, Canada. Canada's public schools have emerged as a popular destination for Chinese families who want an English language education but can't quite afford the high tuition fees or exacting admission standards of elite private academies in the United States and United Kingdom. Unlike the United States, where international students are allowed to study at a public school for only 1 year as an exchange student, Canada's public schools welcome foreign students who are willing to pay their way. Recently, the country has seen a large influx from mainland China. In 2012, the most recent year for which figures are available, the number of all Chinese students in Canada from elementary school through university was over 80,000. The majority of those students attend university, but an estimated 15%, or about 12,000, were in Canada for high school or below, according to immigration experts.
Now what's the matter?
Compared to Canada, the United States remains by far the most popular destination for Chinese students to study abroad. Increasing numbers of Chinese students are coming to the U.S. to further their educations. Chinese students now comprise about a quarter of all foreign students in the United States. But what is involved in the application process, and how do Chinese students fare? We put those questions to two experts in our roundtable discussion. Joining us is Richard Hessel, Principal of Arts and Science Group, a marketer for higher education, and Chris Boner, Executive Director of Vericant, an organization that helps Chinese students interview for American schools and universities. Sarah Williams and I asked, how do Chinese students go about preparing to attend colleges in the United States?
Well, they pretty much go through these days. I don't know how this has changed. My exposure has been the last 4 years or so. They do what American students do. They take AP courses. They take the SAT if they can leave the country to take it, or the ACT. They try to take demanding courses. The one weakness that Chinese students have, particularly for their applications to the most selective institutions. Their experience typically, and this has to do with just the way high schools work in China, they don't have as much experience with community service and extracurricular activities or athletics as an American student would. And so, you know, some of the advice we give them and really involves in strengthening that side of their credentials.
Is that a difficult process in changing their social outlook? I mean, that's a pretty dramatic change for a student.
It is, and that leads to a larger kind of question that I think is a really important one. The experience of a lot of American institutions, I was just on a trip with the college president to China last month. She's a president of a highly selective college. And she said their experience with Chinese students, even though their TOEFL score or their English SAT-2 might be quite good, they're not accustomed to the kind of give and take of the American classroom. So the discussion that goes on challenging the thoughts of the teacher, they're just not well prepared coming out of the culture of Chinese high schools for that kind of experience.
Chris, I wanted to ask you now, of course, I'm sure that these students have to complete and satisfy, you know, to take these TOEFL tests. When it comes to interviewing at your organization, Verikant, what are some of the things that you work on as far as, you know, having these students be able to undergo an interview?
Sure. I mean, I think Rick really highlighted a nice spot, and that is the education system is just completely different from the United States, where it's a teacher to student, and there's absolutely no interaction. And we've found Chinese students are very qualified to do quite well in our classes. It's just what lacks and what we believe differentiates them from one another is their ability to converse, interact in English. And so during the interview process, that's really where it comes out. If you're able to have a one-to-one interaction with that student, if they can carry on a conversation with you, if they make eye contact, all sorts of the non-cognitive or soft skills that we almost take for granted in the U.S. because we've grown up with it. It isn't a part of the education system over there.
Well, that perhaps is an entree to our next question is, why should they study in the United States as opposed to Europe or Australia?
I was just looking at some recent statistics, actually. There's about 500,000 Chinese that'll leave China this year to study abroad. About 47% of them will come to the United States for their study. And, you know, I think a big piece of it's probably soft culture. I mean, they see the United States as a world leader, and they want to come to the U.S. and learn about our culture. And then a lot of times return back to China and take what they've learned and apply it maybe in an entrepreneurial sense or working for multinationals over in China.
Right. I want to add to that thought. We actually did a survey of Chinese high school students about a year ago, and asked them to kind of rank countries in terms of where they would like their university education. And the United States was by far number one. Now, 10 years ago, we might have seen the UK, but that's changed. And I think for the Chinese, they see us as a kind of gold standard. We have a number of the best universities in the world. They know their names. Almost every Chinese student I talk to wants to apply to Harvard. I have to keep emphasizing your odds of getting in are very slim. They see America as a place of creativity and innovation and inventiveness, and I think they think our university education is responsible for that.
Well, I also wanted to ask, a number of years ago, from what I understand, it was more likely that a Chinese student would come here, say, as a graduate student, and now they're coming undergraduate, and also some are even coming in, you know, in high school.
You're right. We see younger and younger students now applying to prep schools in the U.S., boarding schools, some independent day schools, with the hope that if they do that, their chances of admission to the highly selective American colleges and universities will be better.
So I think the underlying decision, the very first one, is, am I going to get into Peking University or Tsinghua University? Those are two of the top universities in China. If it's going to be too difficult, and statistically it's very, very difficult to get into those schools in China, that's when there'll be a strong consideration for going abroad. I've spoken with many Chinese students, and at the end of the day, they would pick Peking University over Harvard if they were to get into both of them. The reason that it's happened so much in the last, I'd say, 6-7 years is because in 2006, we in the United States reduced the difficulty in getting a student visa. So after September 11th, we were very strict on student visas, and then only in 2006 was that relaxed. If it takes a boarding school to get into a top U.S. university, Chinese families will do it. If it means you need to go to a junior boarding school to get into a good boarding school, then to get into a top university, they'll consider that as well.
Another factor, I mean, I don't know. I haven't seen any data on this. But I suspect one of the things that might be motivating parents is concerns over the environment in China. So if you have a young child growing up in Beijing, you're concerned about yourself and breathing that air and what effect it may have on your long-term health. And again, the United States is seen as a pure kind of a physical environment for study.
As far as adjustment to American college life, presumably a more mature student is going to have maybe an easier time in making that adjustment. How has that been for Chinese students historically?
I think it's a difficult one for Chinese students because you have Chinese parents who do basically everything for them. When you're a student in China, your job is to study. It's not to cook food for yourself. It's not to do chores around the house. It's to study and do the best you possibly can. And when all of a sudden come to the United States where we're quite independent, or at least hope to be somewhat independent, and you can do your own laundry and things like that by the time you get to college, I think there are definitely a group of Chinese students who would struggle with that just because they're pretty used to having their parents there to take care of the small things, and they just focus on their studies.
Yeah, I'm going to underscore what Chris said. I mean, Chinese students have much better study habits than American kids in general. And many times they're amused by what they see with their fellow American students, parties, drinking, all that kind of thing. That's not part of the Chinese student experience. And so what they do tend to bundle together. Now, this is not uncommon for racial minorities, for example, on American campuses. So African-American kids hang out together or Hispanic kids hang out together. But I think it's definitely a pattern on a lot of campuses that Chinese students tend to hang out together for cultural reasons.
With the growing number of Chinese students, have there sprung up more support groups and that sort of thing to help the adjustment process?
On the campuses that I know, definitely. A lot of American institutions that have substantial numbers of Chinese students have done a lot to provide them support of all kinds.
I wanted to ask you, kind of wrapping it up now, is there any advice that you would give Chinese students wishing to study here in the U.S.?
Yeah, the advice I would give them is get as many experiences as you can, interchanging ideas, speaking on your feet, intellectual conversations, social conversations, conversations with your teachers, to get experience of this kind of interchange that occurs in the American classroom.
That's a very good question. And I think the number one thing is that in the U.S. we really value someone's individuality. And that's not something that's encouraged at all in the Chinese system. So I know it would be culturally very difficult, and we see it quite often for someone to talk about themselves, to brag about themselves almost during interviews, which us Americans have no problem doing. But I would say celebrate your individuality and really be comfortable with it, because it's really what we look for over here in the U.S.
Richard Hessel, Principal of Arts and Science Group, a marketer for higher education, and Chris Boner, Executive Director of Vericant, an organization that helps Chinese students interview for American schools and universities. With all of these students studying abroad, the question may arise, what about the students who remained in China and graduated from Chinese colleges? According to a new survey conducted by Peking University, more than one-third of recent Chinese graduates continue to live off their parents. A still greater number are failing to save any money, the survey found, with 40% reporting that they live paycheck to paycheck. Part of the problem for graduates is that despite China's booming economy, there is a persistent mismatch between the skills needed on the job market and the ones taught in schools. According to Peking University's survey, among different jobs for graduates, the highest paying ones include hotel managers and logistics professionals, while lower paid workers included those doing car repairs or management in the tourism industry. Whether you're studying abroad, traveling, or just staying at home, we'd love to hear from you. You can email us at voaasia@voanews.com. We're also on social media, Facebook and Twitter. Sarah's handle at VOA Williams. I'm at VOA Stevenson. That's all the time we have for this week's China Focus. I'm Jim Stevenson. Thanks for listening.